Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, today we have an unusual guest, an active ETF manager.
Yeah, I mean, most of the money and the people in ETFs are passive. In fact, some are, you know, cult-like about their allegiance to passive. But here's an active manager that has been finding success.
And she's something of a star. We put her on the Bloomberg 50 last year because she was such a phenomenal entrance into finance in a very unusual way.
Yeah, and I'm very excited. She is completely bucking like many trends at once. She is one of the hottest hands in active management, and there aren't many hot hands. As you know, active is struggling in all facets. It's underperforming largely.
Yeah,
it's seeing
passive,
outflows.
Just eating everything.
Stock pickers are just, they're in essence, they're facing an existential crisis, if you think about it. But Cathie Wood came along a couple years ago and just really shocked the world by coming in and getting a ton of inflows for being active, discretionary, high cost, and she's an independent, no big distribution to help her.
Everything that's different about ETFs.
It's like five hurdles stacked on one another, and she overcame that, largely on great performance. That was part of it. But what she does, which is interesting, is she just focuses on disruptive innovation. That's her main thing. So she's active because she don't want to get stuck in one sector or one theme. She wanted room to move, and she's formerly an active manager. And in retrospect, I got to say it makes sense. If you are going after things that are moving quickly and you have a strategy, it kind of makes sense to be active in this space.
She's also very thematic. What are her ETFs?
The ARK Innovation ETF, which is ARKK, that's the main one. That goes across all sectors. That's sort of like the flagship product. But then she's got one called the Genomic Revolution, Web X.0, the Industrial Innovation, FinTech Innovation, 3D Printing, and an Israel Tech ETF. So you can say that a common thread here, which is she's, in a way, she is living and investing in the future.
That's like her 5 years out.
Yeah. Every time I talk to her, I feel like I'm just a little like slow. Like I'm not, I need to learn more about what's happening. She's really dynamic.
She also makes some big bets. One being, the one that she's probably most famous for if you go on the Twitter, is Tesla.
Yeah, she said Tesla's going to $4,000 in 5 years. That just riled up all of the haters on social media. And so,
especially in a year when the stock's down, you know, 31% or something.
Yeah, I mean, she's one of the rare bulls out there, but she just...
And she's been with it for a long
time.
That's
the thing. She owns the stock. It's the top weighting in her fund. I'm not sure why people get so pissed off when she's actually owning it. I mean, it's not like she's just saying something she doesn't own.
And she trades it. So it's not like a buy and hold position.
Yeah, and so... She's actually had Elon Musk. She has a podcast. She had Elon Musk on her podcast. So I think he was happy to find some people out there who were, you know, with him, because there's a lot of haters of that stock. But really with Cathie, one other thing I want to say is, as we find that active is looking to, you know, how to move forward in this passive world, I think Cathie has developed one way forward, a blueprint, which is to be high active share. Really, you just very concentrated, going for the gold, so to speak, with only like 30 stocks, a lot of bold bets. Bold calls like Tesla, high conviction, not wavering if the stock goes down, and transparency. She shows her holdings every day, shows her trades every day. She crowdsources research, and she's got a big social media presence. Pretty much all those things traditional active funds do not do.
Oh, and by the way, we recorded this while I was on vacation, which is why you'll have to understand that I was calling from the phone. This time on Trillions, Cathie Wood of ARK Investments.
Cathie, thanks for joining us on Trillions.
Happy to be here, Joel.
So when you think about what you do, how do you describe it to your friends and family?
Yes, we are investors, asset managers, focused exclusively on disruptive innovation, nothing else. And these disruptive innovations are technologically enabled. They're going to transform the way the world works and really make it a better place.
And why do you use ETFs?
Well, I started with ETFs because as we were studying thematically the aftermath of the 2008-2009 meltdown, we were trying to discern trends. And what we were seeing was an accelerated trend towards ETFs taking market share. This usually happens in any disruptive innovation. The cheaper, better, faster wins and gains increased traction throughout a very turbulent period. This was holding true with ETFs. And I thought, well, the wrapper's terrific. It solves so many problems for the end investor. Why can't we do active in an ETF? The answer was, there's no reason you cannot if you're willing to disclose your holdings at the end of every day.
I want to go back to the innovation and these broader themes. BlackRock just had a press conference talking about mega trends, and it kind of sounded like what you've been talking about for a while. And I want to bring in Rachel, because Rachel's been covering thematic investing heavily, and she met you a while ago. And just set us up on this whole idea of thematic investing and your experience with Kathy.
Yeah, so I first met Kathy back in, I think it was October 2015. So it's been a while now. She set up her funds back in 2014. So they've been running for about a year at that stage. And my interest was piqued because I heard down the grapevine that Kathy was using these ETFs to actually invest in disruptive industries, but also Bitcoin, which got my attention at the time because I was writing about currencies. And I thought, hang on a second, here's a way we can write about something really interesting without straying too far from my beat. And I went in to meet Kathy and learn a bit more about it. And I was really blown away, really, with how kind of sort of sophisticated that the strategy was at the time. You know, not only was it kind of Bitcoin, it wasn't just crypto focused, it was actually kind of looking at anything that was disrupting things. There were different kind of threads of investment, looking at blockchain, different threads, looking at genomics. It all seemed very kind of like futuristic and new wave. And I found it so interesting that I kept kind of like following the progression of these funds, and then actually ended up writing a story all about kind of Kathy and the success of her business last year.
And so, Kathy, take us back. You started this ETF, but you were doing themes back at your previous job. What turned you on to themes, and why did you ultimately go out on your own?
Well, a couple of reasons I was turned on to themes, specifically technologically enabled innovation, which impacts every sector these days. When I was started in the business, I started in economics. But I knew very quickly I wanted to become an analyst and then ultimately a portfolio manager. And at Jennison Associates, great firm, wonderful mentors, Sig Sigalis, he said, fine, you can do that here, but you're going to have to find your own universe. And the analysts there were lifers. They weren't going anywhere. So I had to just wait around for, you know, new names to show up that kind of fell through the cracks, like database publishing, Reuters, Telerate. We called it database publishing at the time. Nobody wanted to follow that. It didn't belong in either publishing or technology. It was a fall through the crack stock. And so I said, I want to follow that. This sounds really interesting. And of course, it was the precursor to the internet. So very often when ideas are discarded or, you know, dismissed completely as ridiculous, there can be often something very interesting lurking there. It may not show up right away, but sometimes the ideas that are dismissed out of hand become the most important investment opportunities we're going to see, internet being one of them.
I'm thinking of Xerox and the PC.
Yes.
That was another one.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so you started getting into these, and then you were a portfolio manager
at AllianceBernstein. I headed up, I was CIO of the Global Thematic Strategies. And I joined during the tech and telecom bust. At that time, we were just focused on disruption. And in that case, it was the bust. And we were trying to figure out, okay, what are the ramifications of the bust? And how is this going to change technology? And one of the articles that came out at the time was, it doesn't matter. It was a Harvard Business Review. We were trying to get our head around this. Remember, we had the market had gone wild on technology, and here was an article in HBR saying it doesn't matter. And that was a precursor or a foreshadowing of Amazon Web Services, the cloud. And so, again, most people were buying the dip, even in 01 when I started. And we already were on to the next thing. Wait a minute, there's a disruption here. What could this possibly mean? So everything we did was around disruption, but because a lot of technologies were not ready, you know, they were birthed, many of them, during the internet bubble or even way before, but they needed time to gestate. So we were focused on other disruptions, and one of them was, okay, investors have been disrupted. The tech and telecom bust has turned people off stocks. interest rates are only 6% long rates, so nobody's going to want bonds. That, of course, was wrong. Where else are they going? And then we moved into housing as a new asset class, just to give you a sense of how we were looking at disruption at the time. Now the technologies are ready for prime time. They've been gestating these last 20 years, and we are hitting tipping points now where demand for electric vehicles, we think will go up 20-fold during the next 5-6 years. Demand for DNA sequencing is going to go up 40-fold. These are unit growth numbers because costs are moving down so rapidly. And I don't think economists or analysts or portfolio managers are ready for this right now. I don't think research departments are ready for this. They have to restructure because every analyst is going to have to become very conversant and comfortable with technology. And we're focused on 5 technology platforms or innovation platforms. Not only is technology seeping into every sector, blurring sector lines, which I know is important in ETFs, but these 3 innovation platforms, they are converging. So analysts, their responsibilities broken out by very specialized segments of sectors, are not going to be able to analyze these innovations correctly without, again, a restructuring of their responsibilities.
So what are these 5 platforms that you've divided and are using to sort of organize your universe?
Yes, and these would be, in Silicon Valley, they would be considered general purpose technology platforms. We didn't choose these, all of these are at tipping points in terms of adoption. And I can tell you how we get to tipping points, but they are DNA sequencing. The tipping points always happen because costs are collapsing, and they're collapsing there. So that we believe that the number of whole human genomes sequenced, which was 2.4 million last year, that's half of all the genomes ever sequenced in the world, ever. That happened just last year. We think that's going to 100 million in 5 years. And we think it's going ultimately into billions. And it's because costs are collapsing here. And we will get our genome sequenced every year, every other year, to figure out what's mutating in our bodies so we can catch cancer in stage 1, and then we can edit it out with gene editing. So that's one huge platform.
And that's an ETF, ARKG, right? The Genomic Revolution.
The Genomic
Revolution. So that one just focuses on that one.
It does. And it's right. Unusual for us to have a fund that looks like a healthcare sector fund, but it is a slice of healthcare. It is futuristic healthcare, if you look at it. It includes DNA sequencing, molecular diagnostic testing companies, CAR T technology companies, so with immunotherapy, CRISPR gene editing, other kinds of gene therapy. So again, our funds are very forward-looking. You'll find many sector funds are where they are because of what has happened historically. That's true of any index. Our funds tend to be very active relative to, you know, their counterparts, if there are any, in the market, because most counterparts, even if they call themselves innovation, are based on some index. That's the screen. Our screen is not an index. Our screen is our research. So very different. So DNA sequencing, robotics with collaborative robots, the costs are collapsing here. Energy storage, so electric vehicles, Elon Musk leading the charge, so to speak. Artificial intelligence is really part of the next generation internet. It's going to turbocharge the internet, the cloud, if you'd like. And it's ready for prime time because we've pulled human programmers largely out of the equation. And then finally, blockchain technology, which is also part of the next generation internet.
Yeah, and I find this really kind of fascinating because when you look at what's happened since Cathy set up her funds back in 2014 and 2015, you've really seen a proliferation of these types of strategies coming through in the ETF industry. But most of these are passive. If you look at kind of the proportion of passive to active, I ran the numbers, and I think it's only 11% that are actively managed, and a significant number of those are run by Cathy. So it's quite interesting to me that this is a very different approach, because inherently it makes quite a lot of sense when you're thinking about sort of, you know, futuristic looking industries to try and think about something where you're not necessarily pinned down to indexes that, that can only really rebalance on a twice annual or annual kind of basis. So I find that kind of like sort of very interesting about this, this approach that a lot of other people have kind of followed it, but they've chosen to go to the passive, whereas Kathy has that active kind of DNA, as it were.
Yeah, and thank you. Can I just add one thing to that? And thank you, Rachel, for saying that. One of the other benefits of active management is we trade around our names aggressively because disruptive innovation is inherently controversial. And we just lie there and wait. We know that Tesla, when it was in the 380s, we knew it was going to come down. We sold up there, even though our price target is as high as it is. We knew we were going to get opportunities. It never left the top position in the fund, but instead of being at 12 or 13%, we took it down to 8%. If you just isolate the trading activity in Tesla alone, and we do this with all of our names, last year, and we had a number of round trips, if you just isolate that trading alone, the stock itself was up 6.5% last year. But our trading activity alone added another 175 basis points to our performance last year, just that one stock. And we do that with every stock. Now, it is true, Tesla is probably one of the most volatile and most controversial, so we have a lot of opportunities. But that is one of the benefits of active management.
Yeah, and I think before you, though, when I met you, I met you at a conference somewhere downtown, like the Millennial Hotel or something. Yeah. And when you talked about these, I said, I don't think it's going to go that well. I said, you know, I don't know why she doesn't do them passive, because that's just what everybody wants right now. The fact that you made them active at the time, I thought, man, that could sink these, just because people want stuff cheap and passive. Yours are a little on the pricier side, and they're active, but you've defied the odds. Active equity mutual funds have seen, I don't know what the number is, it's probably close to $1 trillion in outflows since you launched. Mm-hmm. You've taken in $2.5 billion in the past 3 years. So you've completely bucked the trend. Talk about that, why you had to go active. Was it just because you couldn't be locked into anything? You had to have that freedom?
Yes. So the number you quoted there are ETFs. They're close to $3 billion now. But we had to do something else, and I'll explain why. We had to pivot because I funded the company for the first 3 years. And what you said, Eric, was actually happening. The network I had in the financial community, and remember, I've been around a long time in this business, and I do have a wonderful network. My network was nowhere to be found on the passive side, on the ETF side. I was shocked that most people I was talking to did not understand what active management was. They just didn't understand it. And so we had to start using other wrappers because, well, we were being asked, would we do it? And that's what you do as a small business. We are now up to $9.5 billion, all active. But any wrapper, we've got two distributors, you know, we sub-advise for mutual funds throughout Asia-Pac, and ETFs, of course, here, mostly in the United States. But interestingly, sovereign wealth funds in other parts of the world have been buying some of our ETFs because they don't have to go through all of the due diligence that, you know, a traditional separately managed account would go through. We also have separately managed accounts. I went to the Morningstar conference in October of 2013. And this was right before we started the company. And on stage was Eugene Fama being interviewed, a fireside chat. And he said at that conference, he said, active management is dead. It is disappearing. And, you know, there might have been 2,000 people in the room and everybody was cheering. And I looked around. I really understood at that moment, oh, my goodness, I'm the only active manager here. This is crazy. I would have thought, you know, doesn't everybody want to know about this wrapper, which is so good and so interesting? So we went to active. When it comes to innovation, it's the only way to manage money. To me, the idea of passive and innovation, that's an oxymoron, right? And the screen for our research is the screen for our portfolios is our research. We are constructing autonomous vehicles. What is it? what goes into it. We're doing first principles research, and we're using something called Wright's Law in order to understand the learning curves, which cause cost declines in these new technologies. And then we use price elasticity of demand. So there's a lot of top-down, you know, how big is this market going to be? If you don't have perspective when you're investing in innovation, you don't have the courage of conviction.
Now, you came out and you just basically hit a home run right out of the gate. Your fund went up like two or three times the S&P 500. I call it the shiny object moment. I'm sure you got a lot of people just giving you looks because of that. How much of the flows that have come in do you think are just people who just saw this crazy performance and bought in versus, you know, talk to you, believe in Kathy, and are there for the long haul?
In the beginning, it's interesting, Rachel mentioned Bitcoin. Most people dismissed us because, oh, it was Bitcoin. So in 87 alone, we were up 87.5%. But if you had just left our Bitcoin in cash, which we wouldn't do, of course, so a conservative way of calculating non-Bitcoin performance, we would have been up low 60s%. So still more than double the market. No, in the beginning, we got, oh, they're using Bitcoin as a gimmick from some journalists in the ETF space that I respect and like a lot. I thought, wow, they didn't read our white papers. We've done so much work on this. So there was an automatic dismissal as this is a gimmick. And we also have had that. We've had that a little bit with Tesla as well. You know, oh, you just want to get out there and if they only saw the research that we put into this. So we've had a great social media and marketing presence, and this has been building slowly. But I think the main thing has been slowly. It's demand pull. The wirehouses were slow to put us on. We're on a few now. We have a few more to go. But it's been demand pull because investors, whether they see us on social media or on other media, they know we are right. They know because they feel technology changing their own lives so quickly, or their children's lives or their grandchildren's lives, and they know they're missing it in their portfolios. They do not have a piece of the action. And they want to, you know, they would like to ride, whether it's 5, 10, 15% of their portfolio. The other thing that I think we've done pretty well is help people understand that traditional indexes are filling up with value traps because of this innovation. So why not use us as a hedge? Even if you're completely passive, you have value traps building up in your value portfolios and in your growth portfolios. That's how fast innovation is evolving.
Who would you say are your buyers for the ETFs? Is it primarily an institutional marketplace, or are you getting your funds into financial advisors or even direct to retail?
It's financial advisors, direct to retail, for sure. We're seeing increasing institutional interest, but that's more funds outside the rest of the world who will, you know, get a taste of innovation through our ETFs and then perhaps invite us in to pitch for an SMA, a separately managed account. But what happened in March of 2016 is we got our first institutional account, a large state employee retirement system in the Midwest, who was my client at my former firm. And they found us. We had tried to find them, but their gatekeepers wouldn't let us in. And then they had a young analyst who was charged with finding out what's going on in innovation. He contacted us. And after 5 months, we realized, oh, I know your boss. I know, you know. And so anyway, they gave us $200 million when we only had $20 million. And so in March 19, we had our 3-year record. Now we're making a big institutional push. And so we're wrapper agnostic now. If an institution wants to use ETFs, fantastic. If separately managed accounts, whatever the reason, fine. Sub-advising for mutual funds, so.
I think, like, Kathy's experience, like, illustrates something that's very common for new issuers in the ETF space as well, though. It's just, it's very hard to get that institutional money, which is obviously where the big bucks lie, when you are small. And you have to kind of, like, have the longevity to get past that 3-year track record before you can really pitch the decision makers that have those millions to spend.
Yes, and it's been very interesting.
Helps.
Yeah, performance has been very helpful. Thanks be to God. I always add that. But I will say, you know, we for a U.S.-based manager, more than half of our assets are in the rest of the world. I think the most important strategic decisions we made were to outsource distribution. So Nikko Asset Management, our partner in the rest of the world, they are scaling us through quickly because Asia is hungry for innovation, particularly the kind of innovation we're researching. They're hungry for our research. And, of course, Resolute Investment Managers in the United States is scaling us here.
So, Kathy, one of the things that I'm really interested in is this idea of your research. So walk us through how you go about finding companies and then from identifying them to allocating to them.
Sure. Well, it starts with our research. So since I started on the autonomous vehicle example, I'll keep going there. We charged our analysts to figure out what was going to make an autonomous vehicle work. And so our director of research, Brett Winton, is an MIT engineer by training, and he needs to break everything down and then build it up and has really guided our analysts to do the same. So to give you an example, Tasha Keeney comes in to our brainstorming on a Friday. She's been working on the autonomous model, and our brainstorm, you're welcome to it anytime you'd like to join. It's from 1 to 3, and it's research-driven. Our analysts come in with the most interesting or controversial, provocative ideas they've heard or the biggest breakthrough they've had in their own research. This week, Tasha comes in and said, it appears that the brains of an autonomous vehicle are going to be GPUs. And I looked at her, and I said, this was 2014. I said, what? I said, NVIDIA? That stock is being thrown out because it's a PC proxy and PCs are dropping at a double-digit rate. It was selling at, I think, 11 times earnings. And then James piped in. He was at NVIDIA for 9 years. And he said, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense because autonomous vehicles are artificial intelligence projects. And GPUs have 80% of all of the do 80% of all the training in artificial intelligence. And I said, James, nobody knows that. No analyst out there knows that. I've been around a while. I know what people think NVIDIA is. And so NVIDIA, which was already in our portfolios for gaming, it was just a small position, though. It was a 1% position. It started moving up pretty. And you know the trading range that Tesla's been in for these last 4 years? NVIDIA was in the same kind of trading range while computer PC shipments were dropping. Every time it dropped to the low end, sort of that $14, we would pick it up. And when it got to $20, we would sell some, and then 14 and 20. And what happens over time, if you get a long enough base, which I believe we have now in Tesla, and certainly did back then in NVIDIA, at one point, it's going to break out of that base because a number of research analysts and then portfolio managers decide, hey, we need some exposure to artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicles. This became the go-to. So it went from $14 in 2015 to $300 in 2018. This is venture-like in terms of its returns. And we consider ourselves the closest you'll find to a venture capital firm in the public equity market. So some 14 to 300. It went from 1% of our portfolios while it was in that 14 to 20 range. We got it into, it would be in the top five. So that would have been in the 5 to 10% range, depending on the portfolio. And as it got to that 300 level and it no longer met our minimum hurdle rate of return, which is a 15% annualized rate of return over 5 years. So that means a doubling every 5 years. If we can't say to ourselves that this stock is going to do that in the next 5 years, then we take, even if it's a core position, we will take it down to the bottom five. So it started in the bottom five, got to the top five in 2017. And then by the time October rolled around last year, when it was at 300, it was back in the bottom five. And then, as you know, it dropped more than 50%, almost 60% in one quarter. And we put it back into the top five because it is going to be one of the biggest autonomous vehicle plays.
So much of that was just identifying sort of a special ingredient that was going to, you know, that you guys are just going to like double down on.
Yeah.
And I guess what I'm wondering is, like, you know, that makes sense for driving, and it makes sense for AI. And clearly, you know, when you think about these five areas that you guys are combing through looking for some of those things. But the other thing that you brought up there was the fact that you're effectively a VC fund.
Right.
And so I'm interested in also the fact that, like, sometimes you might identify something that doesn't come to fruition. How often has that happened?
The reason I use we are the closest you'll find to a VC fund is because of our time horizon. It's 5 years.
Yeah.
What happens before that, though, the reason we have so much of a better shot at a big winner is there's a vetting process that our stocks have gone through. It's called the IPO. You've got regulators, sell side, buy side, bankers. We're not going to run into a Theranos, that's for sure. These are products, they really exist. So I don't think we're a venture firm in terms of any failures in the portfolio. But with time, and what's great about having a 5-year time horizon and building autonomous vehicles from the bottom up, electric vehicles, you know, really understanding battery technology, is we can see, because of our time horizon, we can see where the inefficiencies are in the market. One of the biggest is Tesla today. You know that we're associated with it. And it's because we've done more work on batteries, artificial intelligence, and data, big data collection, than anyone out there when it comes to Tesla and Tesla's competitors. And so our confidence is very high. We can't understand why people can't see this. The reason they can't see it is because they haven't done that research. And the reason they haven't done that research is because auto analysts are following this, not robotics analysts, not artificial intelligence analysts, not big data analysts. So you need a combination, and our analysts are a combination.
And let me tap into Tesla, because to me, Tesla hits at many attributes that to me set you apart from a typical active equity manager. First of all, you have bold calls saying 4,000 is your price target in 5 years. That's bold. Gundlach does the same thing. He's very good at bold calls. You know, you got to break through. There are a lot of people or a lot of competition for attention. Conviction. You bought Tesla even this year when it was down 35%, you kept buying.
Down 45%.
45%. Transparency.
You tend to remember those numbers.
The transparency. You show when you buy Tesla. You actually put your trades on the site every day.
Yeah.
You can see the holdings every day. And then obviously, you know, the crowdsourcing, the research, you put out what you think of Tesla. I think you had an error somewhere where someone pointed out that actually you got fixed. But either way, you're putting it out there. You're getting feedback instantly. And then finally, the strong social media presence, which you just said social media is good for you, but you take a lot of crap. I mean, I've looked. We actually ran some analysis. You get more tweets than like BlackRock pretty much. I mean— And a lot of them are negative, though.
Yeah.
Mostly because Tesla.
Yeah.
You just piss people off with the Tesla thing. But anyway, an active equity manager at like a T. Rowe or Legg Mason, I just don't see them doing any of those things. And it seems like it might be holding them back. Maybe they don't have to go all the way you've gone. But what do you think's going on there? Why do you do it, and yet you don't see many stock pickers doing the same?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, their compliance departments will not allow it. Now, I think this is a huge competitive advantage for us. We are the only one public managers really out there that are willing to share our research and talk about. We can't hype. We have do's and don'ts. Believe me, our chief compliance officer is an attorney who spent 4 years at the SEC when they were evolving standards and guidelines for social media and marketing. So he is maniacal about making sure we do not say something that puts us on the wrong side of regulation. But in terms of sharing our research, what has happened? I believe we're the first sharing economy company in the asset management space when it comes to research. What has happened now is we are living in the communities we're researching, because we have people who are connecting with us saying, hey, that's our world. And yes, you're getting this right, or you're not getting that right. And maybe you should think about this. So we are getting insights from the innovators we're researching that others cannot get, because they're not living in those communities and they're not sharing what they're doing. I think it is a huge competitive advantage. And I think compliance departments will have to let up, because I do believe Twitter and other social networks are going to be very important knowledge networks.
And this is almost in like contrast to the other kind of big sort of theme that we're seeing this year, which is sort of about active managers looking to get into ETFs but not disclose their holdings. You know, obviously Precidian kind of coming through and getting that approval from the SEC to start these funds. The whole idea there is to help active managers into the space that previously were put off because they didn't want to share that secret source that they feel kind of sets them apart. So it's kind of really interesting that on the one hand you have, you know, these funds that Cathy's kind of brought out that have been able to deliver these returns and do rely on having this kind of crowdsourced information. And yet you also have at the same time active managers that are trying to preserve that secret source and see that as very much their way that they can get equivalent returns and deliver for investors.
And do you think active managers out there, there's $6 trillion in active equity funds that are eyeing this Presidium model? Mm-hmm. It's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Do you think they overestimate the front-running issue or overestimate people even caring about their picks?
I can tell when we are being played with, you know, by high-frequency traders or so forth, but that's easy to deal with. As an active manager, you just put a limit. You don't buy – if someone's playing this has happened to me my entire career, you know. When I used to give models to the wirehouses for SMAs, someone out there knew what we were doing. That's why I think it's overstated. They all put their portfolios out there every day to these wirehouses to populate their separately managed accounts. So I've never understood that really. And they have control, limit orders. You can do that. So I've never bought that. I will say it's easier for us because we're liquidity providers. You'll notice what I said. We're quite contrarian in our trading. So when we've got hedge funds dumping all over our some of our stocks, we're going to be buyers if there are high conviction stocks. Same on the other side. We catch a lot of flack sometimes when we sell as well because they say, wait a minute, your price target is this and you're selling. The idea is there's going to be controversy around these ideas. You've got the old guard and the new guard. And you've got a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And you've got new technologies that are going to blow away some of the old guard. So there's a big tug of war there. And we can play that as a liquidity provider. Others are more momentum oriented. They're going to be stopped out if people start chasing them. But I just think it's great that active, you know, allocating capital to its highest and best use, meaning looking to the future, trying to make the world a better place. I think active is the next big wave for ETFs. So, you know, personally, I prefer transparent. And you know why I prefer transparent? It's because our clients prefer transparent. They want to be a part of this process. They want to understand. And, you know, we also on Fridays put out any stock that's moved up or down more than 15% in any day. We put it out there and say, hey, this happened. We want you to know why and, you know, how we feel about it. So I think 08-09 caused so much distrust in the financial services industry that transparency became paramount. The one thing that these active managers who are planning to come over, maybe the $6 trillion, the problem with many of them is they are benchmark sensitive. And I don't believe there's nearly as much a market for that as there once was when it comes to active. You've got the whole ETF industry is fulfilling a lot more needs than it did in the past, and is, you know, stealing the march from active if they're not bold.
And speaking of that boldness, now I put out a tweet about, you're known for Tesla, but some of your other stock picks have actually done well and offset some of the Tesla losses this year. You're up 150% in ARKK since launching, and the S&P is up 62%. But that's a lot of high beta names. Like, this could reverse. Like, let's say the Fed has a 2008, but on steroids. Mm-hmm. Somebody replied to me and said, won't end well. Like, we've seen this before, the Janus 20. Mm-hmm. What do you say to those skeptics that this high active share, high octane, high beta methodology has a downside?
Well, that is why I like to trade these names. We like to, again, lie in wait. But when it comes to disruptive innovation, if we get into a really turbulent period, 08-09, perfect example. Because our names are not big names in the indices, they are going to be hurt disproportionately in the beginning of that move down. But 08-09 was very instructive. Now, I was at another firm at the time, but we started out and we were had moved much more towards disruptive innovation, technologically enabled. We started outperforming November 24th, 08. And in the first quarter, 09, when the market was down 10%, we were flat. Why? It's because cooler heads prevailed. Analysts and portfolio managers started looking at the fundamentals, and they learned that Amazon's worst quarter, remember, Amazon was destroyed back then. Amazon's worst quarter, as retail sales were down 10, 20%, Amazon's worst quarter was up 14%. Salesforce.com's worst quarter when tech spending was down 20%, up 20% revenue growth. But even though it had been destroyed, so they started looking at the fundamentals. Our companies gain traction because they're better, cheaper, faster, more productive, and gain tremendous share during downturns.
So when we first met, we were talking about Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And I know that you kind of sold down Bitcoin and kind of reduced your positions in that as we came off those incredibly meteoric highs. Obviously, Bitcoin's back in the news again. It's mm-hmm. been going back up again. Have you guys been increasing your holdings? Where do you see Bitcoin at the moment?
This is very important for investors to understand. What we learned in 2017, and we had the wild ride, you're right, and we cut it at a great time. But we almost had to, because when it started forking, we learned that we had unqualified income. And when it hit 10% of our funds, we had to sell it below that. That created unqualified income. Only 10% of gross profits can be in the form of unqualified income. The rest will be confiscated by the IRS. So we have taken it. This is simply because of we're a registered investment company and these are 40 Act funds. So we've taken it out of ARKK. We've minimized it in ARKW. It's about a 2% position. In our discretionary accounts, separately managed accounts, it's our number two position at an 8% weight. Our conviction in Bitcoin has only increased in the last 2 years. We think it is being battle tested as the global digital currency, and there will only be a few cryptocurrencies at the end of the day.
Okay, so. Another bold call, but I want you to be bold and look yourself in the mirror. We talked a lot about the future. 5 years from now, Kathy, what does Kathy look like? What does ARK look like?
Well, I love the way our research ecosystem is evolving to embrace universities, and venture capitalists are coming in because they know we're doing the first principles research that is not done enough out there. So I really want our research ecosystem to flourish, partly because one of our missions and values is to educate our investor base and really increase the efficiencies in an inefficiently priced market right now. So of course, we'd love to scale globally. We're doing that right now. As I mentioned, more than half of our assets are outside the United States. We'd like to do more in terms of education. Our capacity, we get asked about capacity a lot. And people say, well, this is niche-y capacity. You know, if we are right and these innovation platforms are ready for prime time and are scaling exponentially, our capacity should be able to scale exponentially as well. So we do not have the capacity problem that a lot of other managers might have. And then just on a personal basis, in terms of this innovation, I have found it so interesting since starting the firm. In the early days, I had a lot of self-selection, women asking, you know, to join. Now that we've been this successful, I'm getting fewer women, much more men. And so one of my objectives, and I've already started this in my high school, I went to an all-girl high school, is I've started an innovation center in my father's honor. He's the radar expert and my inspiration. And I want to inspire these girls with a curriculum around disruptive innovation so that they are inspired at a young enough age to really just want it and want to run hard with it. So that's just on a little personal note. But I think you know, if you compare what's happening today with any other time in history, first you have to go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, telephone, electricity, internal combustion engine. If you look at the amount of innovation that's going to take place today, we have a paper on this on our site. And if you use a Richter scale for your to try and understand how different this is going to be, you would measure the 50 years ended 1929 at maybe a 6 or a 6.5. But in terms of what's about to happen, I think it's going to measure an 8 or 9. Now, you never want to be in an earthquake like that. In other words, you do not want to be disrupted. You want to embrace this change. And, you know, this is not a linear, you know, 6 to 8 or 9 is not linear. This is an exponential change. So I really feel every portfolio needs exposure to it. And, you know, we'd like to be a part of that.
Okay, there you go. Kathy, Rachel, thanks for joining us on Trillium.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you'd like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. You can find Kathy at Kathy D. Wood. That's Kathy with a C and an IE, as well as at ARK Invest. And Rachel is at RachelEvans_NY. Trillions is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.